Galactic Interstellar Council on Revolution Radio Studio A, Fridays at 2 p.m. Eastern. Join us as we traverse the starseed paradigm, as expressed in the time-space continuum that we know as the divine expression of love and light. Integrating this conscious unity into the galactic paradigm. So welcome all, both terrestrial beings and galactic beings as one. So be it. You're listening to Revolution Radio.
Thank you for listening to Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. Any commercial advertising you may hear in this program is of the sole discretion and benefit of the host of whose program you are listening to. Revolution Radio does not endorse any commercial products, nor does it accept monetary compensation for on-air advertising of commercial products, nor will it ever. We are and shall remain 100% listener-supported. Any product advertising on this program are considered used at higher risk, and Revolution Radio shall not be held liable for any claims or damages received from any product advertised within this program. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
Oh, this is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Raw Deal. As everyone in the world is aware, Russia has long since taken possession of Crimea and the Donbass region. In my opinion, the battle for Bakhmut is the decisive, pivotal turning point of the war. Russia's all but completed using the Wagner Group, which apparently are really highly trained disciplined mercenaries. I guess you could compare them to Blackwater or the, group that ran the Boston bombing, Kraft International, private armies. But these guys appear to be truly superb. Now, the president of Ukraine has declared there will be no peace agreement with Russia unless Russia agrees to surrender those territories, which is not in the cards. It's not going to happen. The West from the beginning underestimated the military capabilities of Russia, which it is demonstrating only intermittently, such as by the dagger attack on the underground bunker. I mean, this was 300 feet under the ground that had around, coincidentally, 300 NATO, U.S., Polish, Ukrainian officers. It was a command and control center for the Ukrainian war effort. Where we now know that the West used the Minsk Accords as a cover, as a fig leaf, for strengthening Ukraine with all kinds of military equipment, tactics, training. The reason why, even though initially it looked as though Russia might mop things up in a matter of weeks, because of this tremendous buildup of the strength of the Ukrainian army, the West was actually already running a proxy war against Russia, which is why, of course, they're so upset with this Air Force National Guardsman, who, in the tradition of Edward Snowden and Pentagon Papers, leaked documents showing the U.S. had been there prior to the Russian special military intervention and that Ukraine is losing the war. Now, you're not hearing any of that in the mainstream media when they attack this guy. But it seemed to me he's as much of a hero as Daniel Ellsberg and Edward Snowden have been in the past. He deserves our praise and our admiration. You're not hearing a single word about the content of the documents he released, because it's devastating. It shows the West mega liars, mega phonies, mega frauds. And that's MEGA, not MAGA. If Trump were in office, none of this nonsense would be taking place, though he would have had to undo the coup engineered by Victoria Nuland using $5 billion in American taxpayer dollars of 2014 that took out the Russia-friendly president and installed him with the Western public, of whom Zelensky is his successor. And that's when all the attacks on the Donbass, which is populated with ethnically Russian, Russian-speaking, Russian-friendly citizens, artillery barrages began in 2014, killing by the time the special intervention took place in May as 2,000 residents of the Donbass. Indeed, it was a discovery that Zelensky was about to launch a massive attack on the Donbass that would lead to the slaughter maybe of millions. Large number would have been taken out that prompted Putin to intervene. Now, Zelensky's in a bad place, and that attack on the bunker was devastating because those were their best people. Those were the brains of the Ukrainian military effort, taken out in a single strike by a hypersonic missile. This travels very low to the ground beneath the radar. Then as it approaches its target, it zips upward to come down with tremendous force deep into the ground. Devastating. So, what's going on? How's Ukraine responding? Well, they've launched some drone attacks against Crimea. Here is one, Russian official. Ukrainian drone attacks at Crimean fuel depot ablaze. The strike comes amid a recent uptick in attack on Crimea, which even the hawkish Secretary of State Anthony Blinken has acknowledged could cross Moscow's red line and provoke a severe reaction dated 29 April. A Ukrainian drone strike on an oil storage facility in the Crimean port of Sevastopol caused a massive fire. This comes amid an escalation of attacks against Crimea, annexed by Russia in 2014. Strictly speaking, that's the wrong word, in my opinion. There was a referendum that was conducted in accordance with international law, and the residents of Crimea overwhelmingly voted to rejoin Russia. And as the ever-imminent Ukrainian counteroffensive in the south and east is expected to fail. Despite earlier reporting of as many as four drones being involved in the strike, Mikhail Razvahev, Russian-appointed governor of Sevastopol, said experts have since examined the site, and it's clear only one drone was able to reach the oil reservoir, although another was downed, which shows, of course, how much damage a single drone can do. The blaze at the city's harbor was assigned the highest ranking in terms of how difficult it would be to extinguish. But reports are that the fire has now been contained. A Ukrainian military intel official has claimed over 10 oil tanks were destroyed, which would be roughly 40,000 tons of fuel for use by the Russian Black Sea Fleet. Ukraine has not taken official responsibility for the attack, where Kiev rarely admits its role in operations on the peninsula. Sevastopol has seen regular attempts at drone strikes, particularly in recent weeks. Monday, Russia Defense Ministry reported its forces had repelled Ukrainian naval drones seeking to target the Black Sea Fleet. According to the Associated Press, one of the unnamed aircraft was destroyed while another blew up, causing some shattered windows in many apartment buildings in the surrounding area. Reportedly, with no further damage. Last month, a Ukrainian military spokeswoman implied Kiev had carried out a drone attack in northern Crimea, destroying a shipment of Russian cruise missiles being transported by rail. Russian authorities have disputed that version of events and maintained the drone attack targeted civilian residential areas. Ukrainian military released a vague statement claiming such strikes advance the process of Russian demilitarization and prepares the Ukrainian peninsula of Crimea for deoccupation. Fat chance. Now, you notice they mentioned a counteroffensive. Well, everybody seems to know this is happening. Former CIA director, U.S. trained Ukrainian counteroffensive to begin in May. So it's not going to come as any surprise. You know it. I know it. Russia knows it. On March 30th, 2023, former CIA director David Petraeus spoke at the Bush School in District of Columbia on international conflicts and U.S. national security challenges. During his presentation, Petraeus announced the U.S.-trained Ukrainian counteroffensive will begin in May with a goal of severing Russia's land route to Crimea. This speech by Petraeus took place before leaked documents surfaced that Ukrainian forces were suffering major losses in the war with Russia, and the U.S. forces were already on the ground in Ukraine, something not disclosed to the American public, unknown before the leak. Former CIA Director David Petraeus says the U.S.-trained Ukraine counteroffensive is scheduled to begin in May with a goal of severing Russia's land route to Crimea, while also demonstrating to Putin that the Ukrainians are willing to outsuffer the Russians. That's a joke. What we really need to watch is not what's happening on the battlefield right now. It's what's happening at training centers U.S. runs in Germany, Grafenwöhl, Hohenfels, the U.K., Poland, and Ukraine itself, where entire new brigades are being established largely with new recruits from Ukraine, but also with some seasoned commissioned and uncommissioned officers implied from the West, including, no doubt, the United States. Longtime listeners will no doubt recall that ISIS, which was created by then CIA Director John Brennan with the complicity and approval of then Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and then President of the United States Barack Obama over the adamant opposition of Michael Flynn, director then of the Defense Intelligence Agency, a terrorist army that would rape, loot, and pillage in the Middle East, especially in Syria, was populated with a lot of former U.S. Army sporting tattoos. I reported on this many, many times. So the idea we'd have former Army or whatever involved here at the train with Ukraine comes as no surprise. There's lots of precedent. Over time, this counter-effective was coming from Petraeus. Will be equipped with Western tanks or with the residual Soviet bloc systems, Western infantry fighting vehicles, Western wheeled armored vehicles, really quite an extraordinary array of systems. And this late May, early June, now we're getting more specific to late May or even early June, there's going to be a heck of an offensive from the Ukrainians, very likely in the south. It probably has to be roughly the Melitopol area. And they'll try to sever the ground lines of communication Russia's established along the southeast coast of Ukraine, linking to Crimea. I believe they're going to achieve for the first time in this war true combined arms effect, because they will for the first time. Russians have not at all done this. They have failed from day one. They have tanks just right down the road without infantry. The Ukrainians will have tanks with infantry and infantry fighting vehicles, keeping the enemy's infantry and their anti-tank guided missiles off those tanks. They will have engineers and EOD to produce obstacles and defuse explosives in mine. They will have air defense to keep the Russian air off them. This is all Petraeus extolling the virtues of this attack. They'll have electronic warfare to join the Russian networks. They'll have artillery and mortars to suppress the enemy forces. They'll have good command and control. They'll have logistic push right up behind them with additional arms, ammunition, armed fuel, water, food, medical support. They'll have reserve forces, which they did not have in the offense in the Kharkov area last fall. That was very impressive, but basically culminated, ran out of steam, because human beings can only go on for about 74 hours before they physically no longer have the capacity to do much on the battlefield. We've reached that point, by the way. We proved this during the fight for Baghdad a couple of different times. I believe that's what's going to happen. The question then, we might actually ask the DA privately later the question, can Putin over time convince he'll not be able to outsuffer the Ukrainians, the Europeans, and the Americans? Which is what he currently thinks. He thinks that, again, Russians, just as they did in Napoleon's army and to the Nazis, are going to prevail over time because they have more fortitude. Well, there's no doubt about it. They do have more fortitude. The idea that this counteroffensive, which everyone knows is about to happen, is going to succeed, is just ridiculous. Daydreams. Russia's going to cream them. Right? Listen, you shouldn't have any serious doubt about it. I speak as a former Marine Corps officer, familiar with military history and tactics, and I tell you, there isn't a chance that this is going to succeed. Thus, here's a more recent piece. Biden's team fears the aftermath of a failed Ukrainian counteroffensive. Behind closed doors, the administration worries about what Ukraine can't accomplish. This is dated now April 24th. The Biden administration is quietly preparing for the possibility that if Ukraine's swing counteroffensive falls short of expectation, critics at home and allies abroad will argue that America's come up short too. Ukraine's ever-imminent counteroffensive will attempt to retake Russian-seized territory, most likely in the east and south. Over operational reasons, no senior officials from Kiev have detailed specifics publicly. President Biden's team has offered unwavering support for Ukraine, pledging to load it up with weapons and economic aid for as long as it takes. But if the impending fighting season yields limited gains, administration officials have expressed privately they fear being faced with a two-headed monster attacking it from the hawkish and dovish ends of the spectrum. That means political attacks right here at home. One side will say Ukraine's advances would have worked had the administration given Kiev everything it asked for, namely longer-range missiles, fighter jets, and more air defense. The other side, administration officials worry, will claim Ukraine's shortcoming to prove it can't force Russia out of its territory completely. That doesn't even account for the reaction of America's allies, mainly in Europe, to me see a peace negotiation with Ukraine and Russia as a more attractive option if Kiev can't prove victory is around the corner. And I guarantee you, there's not even the most remote prospect of Ukrainian victory. Inside the administration, officials stress they're doing everything possible to make this spring offensive succeed. We've nearly completed the request of what Ukraine said they needed for the counteroffensive, as we have surged weapons and equipment to Ukraine over the past few months, said one admin official who, like others, was granted anonymity to discuss sensitive internal considerations. But belief in the strategic cause is one thing. Belief in the tactics is another. And behind closed doors, the administration is worried about what Ukraine can accomplish. Those concerns recently spilled out into the open during a leak of classified information onto social media. A top-secret assessment from early February stated that Ukraine would fall well short of its counteroffensive goals. More current American assessments are that Ukraine may make some progress in the south and east, but won't be able to repeat last year's success. And, of course, they're talking about the leaks from that Air Force source whom I've compared to Daniel Ellsberg and Edward Snowden. Ukraine has hoped to sever Russia's land bridge to Crimea, and U.S. officials are now skeptical that will happen, according to two admin officials familiar with the assessment. But there are still hopes in the Pentagon that Ukraine will hamper Russia's supply lines there, even if total victory over Russia's newly fortified troops ends up too difficult to achieve. Moreover, U.S. intelligence indicate that Ukraine simply does not have the ability to push Russian troops from where they were deeply entrenched, and a similar feeling is taking hold about the battlefield elsewhere in Ukraine, according to officials. Ukraine President Zelensky says the U.S. hasn't adequately armed its forces properly, and so until then, the counteroffensive can begin. There is belief that Kiev is willing to consider adjusting its goals. According to American officials, a more modest name might be easier to be sold as a win. There has been discussion, per aides, of framing it to the Ukrainians as a ceasefire, not as permanent peace talks, leaving the door open for Ukraine to regain more of its territory at a future date. Incentives would have to be given to Kiev, perhaps NATO-like. Remember, Ukraine is not a member of NATO. Threatening to become a member was part of what prompted Putin to enter the fray. Security guarantees, economic help from European Union, more military aid to replenish and bolster Ukraine's forces and the like. And aides have expressed hope of re-engaging China to push Putin to the negotiating table as well. But that would still lead to the dilemma of what happens next and how harshly domestic critics respond if the counteroffensive does not go well. The administration has only itself to blame for withholding certain types of arms and aid at the time it was most needed, said Kurt Volker, the special envoy for Ukraine during the Trump administration. A counteroffensive that doesn't meet expectation will also cause allies and foreign capitals to question how much more they can spare if Kiev's victory looks further and further away. European public support may wane over time as European energy and economic costs stay high, said Clementine Starling, a director and fellow at the Atlantic Council think tank in Washington, D.C. A fracturing of transatlantic support likely hurt U.S. domestic support and Congress, and the Biden admin may struggle to sustain it. All that, I think, is quite accurate, There's no possible way, in fact, that Ukraine is going to be able to launch a successful counteroffensive to take Crimea, regain control of the Donbass. It's not in the cards. It's a dream. It's wishful thinking. So what's going on here? Well, we've thrown so many eggs in the basket. Ukraine is so crucial to the new world order. Ukraine is supposed to be the new Israel. Have no doubt about it. The Israelis are all in. The Rothschild banking empire has declared, no less an eminence than Jacob Rothschild, that Vladimir Putin is an enemy of the New World Order, and that the New World Order cannot move forward without Ukraine. In that regard, therefore, I regard Vladimir Putin as fighting the good fight for all of humanity. In this battle, he is a white hat. He is doing the right. Whereas Nick Kullerstrom, whom I recently interviewed, has observed this is a just war. He's fighting to protect the ethnic Russians in the Donbass from slaughter. He's also in the process, by the way, taking out all those biolabs that were supported by the U.S. Department of Defense. Any way you look at it, we are the bad guys. The Russians are the good. Don't have any illusions. Don't let yourself be played. And I guarantee 100% the Ukrainian ceasefire will fail.
Take a moment to thank the listeners and hosts for all their support that has made Revolution Radio one of the biggest platforms for free speech in an ever-growing dark world of censorship. Unfortunately, this platform for free speech has never been free. We need the support of the people. It is the people like you, yes, you, that keeps the station in the front lines of the battle against tyranny and oppression. Please help support Revolution Radio so free speech will not be silenced in a world that seems to be going deaf to the real truth. With your support, we will be able to become an even bigger pillar of light in a dark world.
Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported radio station on the planet. Revolution Radio.
Hey, everyone. It's Barbara Jean Lindsay, the Cosmic Oracle. If you have questions about your past lives or future plans, need answers from the cosmos about your love life or career, or just want to keep your finger on the pulse of the planet, check out my show, The Cosmic Oracle, here on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com.
Amazon banned my book so you wouldn't learn what really happened at Sandy Hook. It was a FEMA drill presented as mass murder to promote gun control. Then they sued to shut me up, and the Wisconsin courts played along. I have the proof and the law on my side. What I don't have is the money. They want to do to us what they've already done to Canada. Take guns, impose tyranny. It's on the way with Remington's help. First insurance, then registration, then confiscation. I'm asking SCOTUS to stop it. GiveSendGo.com, funding Fetzer. Check it out. This is for all the marbles.
Was it a conspiracy? Did you know that the police in Boston were broadcasting, "This is a drill, this is a drill," on bullhorns during the marathon? That the Boston Globe was tweeting that a demonstration bomb would be set off during the marathon for the benefit of bomb squad activities? And that one would be set off in 1 minute in front of a library, which happened as the Globe had announced. Peering through the smoke, you could see bodies with missing arms and legs. But there was no blood. The blood only showed up later and came out of a tube. They used amputee actors and a studio-quality smoke machine. Don't let yourself be played. Check out And Nobody Died in Boston Either. Available at moonrockbooks.com. That's moonrockbooks.com.
Revolution Radio every Wednesday 8 p.m. Eastern Time on Studio B for Momentary Zen with host Zen Garcia at freedomslips.com, the People Station.
The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates.
You're listening to Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
Well, of course, the Rothschilds is the most powerful Jewish family in world history. They already own roughly 80% of the world's wealth. They want to make it a whole 100. I just discovered this morning a piece about the history of Jewish ritual murder that I want to share with you. It seems to me it's important to assess whether these ideas, you know, that the Rothschild through the Great Reset could be undertaking mass murder of most of the world population. We're talking about billions of people. Where I've already published now a recent article, 5 signs that over a billion have already died. Is that possible? Is it anti-Semitic to suggest that the Rothschilds behind the Great Reset are undertaking the mass murder of billions? Controversial. Well, this looks like a very balanced attempt to address it on Rumble. Check it out.
There is a dark matter still in the world today. It is something that is perhaps older than written language itself, human ritual sacrifice. And it has been something for which Jewish extremists have often been accused of throughout time. Understandably, since it's not an everyday topic, many people are highly skeptical of this bizarre accusation that has burdened the Jewish people for at least 2,000 years. After all, why would fanatical Jews in the past, and perhaps even to this very day, commit human sacrifice? Many people do not like to even think about the topic, believing it to be just pure, unadulterated, anti-Jewish propaganda. And likewise, the Jews themselves are quick to say that such claims are lies, which have been handed down through the centuries. However, there are two sides to this issue. One side believes Jewish ritual murder is not merely anti-Jewish propaganda, but a fact. One that has had a terrible impact on society since it began. Perhaps some viewers may doubt what is uncovered in this video, but an honest glimpse into this matter may make you think. Likewise, an in-depth and fair examination will make most skeptics into true believers. It is true that many of the people who conducted research into these matters were branded by Jews with the epithet of anti-Semite, a term that it seems is used by Jews to stifle discussion on any topic that criticizes them. Certainly, however, if someone who is branded an anti-Semite by Jews says the sky appears blue on a sunny day, is it any less blue just because the so-called anti-Semite said it was? This is usually the case with respect to these matters. While some people who investigated these matters were really anti-Semites, it was the fact that human sacrifice was practiced by Jews that caused many of these people to become anti-Semites. After uncovering the secret among the Jewish cult in times past, how could a Gentile feel otherwise? After all, it is not the anti-Semite who commits the foul act of human sacrifice, now commonly referred to as Jewish ritual murder. Yet Jews sought to make the Gentiles who reported these crimes appear worse than the Jews who committed them. Most historians know and admit that human sacrifice has occurred in the past amongst various sects. The Aztecs' bloodstained temples attest to this. Many innocents met their fate that way, with their hearts plucked from their bodies. The practice called sati in India, where women would sacrifice themselves in flames, is still practiced today in obscure parts where some of India's 1 billion, mostly Hindus, live. In Mexico, even just a few years ago, a strange cult was uncovered that had sacrificed many people, including American college student Mark Kilroy. The same is true of Africa and various parts of South America today. If you merely comb the internet, you realize that, yes, there are some groups who still engage in barbaric practices such as human sacrifice. So, what are the facts about the Jews? Have they also engaged in such terrible acts in the past? And could there be some primitive sect amongst Jews, extremists no doubt, who to this very day still commit the wicked crime of ritual murder? Most Jews, if asked about ritual murder, will vehemently deny any knowledge of it, of course. And they're probably telling you the truth. If there are Jewish hate mongers who engage in these acts, and there is strong evidence to indicate such, it is probably only a small number of them. So if this is indeed the case, one question still remains. What makes these crimes stand out apart from other cruel acts committed by man against man in the past? The answer to this question is not a pretty one. Based on numerous reports from the past to modern times, the main difference is the degree of cruelty. Reports say children sacrificed in Jewish occult rites were tortured to death in the most cruel and heartless ways imaginable. After the ceremony, Jews reportedly dried the child's blood, often absorbing it into paper, for their various occult rites. Aside from claims of Jewish ritual murder being carried out in an extremely vicious manner, there's one other difference that sets this crime apart from others. When such crimes are uncovered, not only the local Jewish groups, but Jews from all over the entire world seek to conceal it. In the past, Jews have even set aside a special fund to cover up such acts. However, by doing this, they become, as the police might say, an accessory after the fact. From time to time, there have been brave and honest Jews who would deviate from their kinsfolk and admit to the truth of these crimes. While such honesty was not common amongst Jews, it still occurred on occasions. For this reason alone, a blanket indictment against all Jews cannot be made. Indeed, some Jews, young and old, have admitted these crimes in front of court, written about them in books, discuss them in debates, and so forth. For the most part, however, Jews typically deny such accusations. They have even developed a phrase for this type of accusation, blood libel. This term is often used as a rallying cry amongst Jewish groups. But let's go to the crux of the matter. When did it begin? And is there evidence to show that this has been a regular occurrence? Usually, when you think of Jews and human sacrifice, you would probably think of the incident between Abraham and Isaac in the Old Testament, where Abraham believed his God wanted him to sacrifice his son, until an angel supposedly appeared and told him otherwise. Many people erroneously believe that human sacrifice amongst Jews ended right then and there for all Jews. But just think about that for a second. Now, Abraham, here he is getting ready to sacrifice his very own son. Abraham reportedly stopped. But what about all the other Jews? Did they too? There is strong evidence to suggest otherwise.
Jewish sacrifice in the Old Testament occurs in many, many more places than simply the better-known story of Abraham and the sacrifice of his son Isaac. Jephthah the Gileadite, cited in Judges 11, King Ahaz, King Manasseh, Jeroboam, many others engaged in this practice, this diabolical practice.
Children who were sacrificed were often burnt in a pit called a tophet. Drums were beaten in an attempt to conceal the child's cries. This practice was quite prevalent amongst Jews who lived in Carthage around 300 years before Christ and who worshipped Baal, another name for Lord. Even today you'll hear of a rabbi Baal. Just do a search on the internet. When losing a battle in Syracuse, nearly 500 children were tossed into a burning tophet as a sacrifice to Baal. Sometimes children were put in the arms of a bronze bull, which had a furnace below it, and those committing this vicious act then allowed the flames to consume the child. The level of cruelty in these cases knew no bounds. One thing that some may find rather odd is the key term used by Jews to describe their act of human sacrifice. They call it Holocaust. As surprising as this may seem to some, the word Holocaust is a Jewish word that was used to describe the act of putting a child into the flames as a sacrifice to their deity. Of course, Jews have assigned a completely different meaning to the term nowadays, but if you take a look at an older dictionary, you will see that we're right about this.
Holocaust is a most interesting term. Literally, it means a burnt offering. And they want you to think, the Jews want you to think mostly of the alleged burnings of World War II era. But it really goes back to the ancient Semitic god Moloch, who demanded the sacrifice of children burned alive in a huge, horrible temple that was built to him. The worship of Moloch was brought in by the foreign concubines of Solomon and became rather firmly established in ancient Israel.
Ancient historians such as Apion, Democritus, and Posidonius described instances of Jewish ritual murder. In 168 before Christ, Apion reported an intended victim, an adult, not a child, was found at the Jewish temple. Jewish historian Flavius Josephus disagreed with Apion's findings, which were translated and published by Thackeray in his book Josephus. Thackeray reported, Antiochus found in the temple a couch on which a man was reclining. The king's entry was instantly hailed by this man with adoration. Falling to his knees, he stretched out his right hand and implored the king to set him free. Thereupon the king reassured him and bade him tell him who he was, why he was living there, and what was the meaning of this abundant fare. In a pitiful tone and full of sighs and tears, the man told the tale of his distress. He said he was a Greek, and that while traveling about his province for his livelihood, He was suddenly kidnapped by men of a foreign race and conveyed to the temple where he was locked up. Finally, the attendants who were waiting upon him told him of the one unutterable law of the Jews, a ritual which was repeated annually at a fixed time. They would kidnap a Greek foreigner and then convey him to the forest where they would slay him, sacrificing his body with their customary ritual, eat of his flesh, and while immolating the Greek, swear an oath of hostility against the Greeks. The remains of their victims were thrown into a pit. In the first millennium of the current era, in the year 300, Bishop Eusebius of Caesarea said that Jews in all communities ritually murdered Christians during their Purim festivals. In the year 415, Socrates Scholasticus reported that Jews of Emesar bound a Gentile child on a cross and poked him till he died. In 425, Baronius reported Jews had crucified a child. In 614, the monk Antiochus Strategos reports that when Jerusalem fell to the Persians, Jews purchased one of the Gentiles who had been captured by the Persians and slew him like a sheep. In 1067, Prague, six Jews reportedly drained blood from a three-year-old child. It was also discovered that these Jews had dispersed the child's blood, giving it to other Jews in Treviso. In 1096, a child by the name of Estrati was reportedly discovered having been ritually murdered in what is now known as the city of Kiev. He was later made a saint. In the year 1115, near the city of Magdeburg, Germany, on the day prior to Passover, Hasidic Jews tortured five children and used their blood in occult rites. The incident was investigated, and the Jews were found guilty and punished accordingly. Up until that time, many of the previous incidents had probably been forgotten. It seems likely that most historical records regarding these incidents were lost over time. In the year 1144, an incident occurred to a child in England that would make history and the Jews not easily forgotten. It had been just a little over 50 years since Jews were first permitted to enter England in 1089. A small number of them had just been brought to England in an effort to assist the king with collecting his taxes. Consequently, as the town discovered to their dismay, a child by the name of William was ritually murdered. But what made this event different was that this child was related to an educated monk, Thomas of Monmouth.
In 1144, a Catholic monk, Thomas of Monmouth, wrote an extensive book about the murder of little William of Norwich, a young boy who was murdered by the Jewish ritual murder cult. He was created a saint of the Catholic Church, the first of many of a series of saints. Depending on how one counts them, there are at least 20 to 25 of them in the history that are recognized as Christian martyrs by the Catholic Church.
This event that occurred to William, like so many before it, could have eventually sunk into obscurity. But Thomas wanted to let the whole world know about this cruel and vicious nature of these wicked acts once and for all, probably with the hope of putting a stop to them. His book was written in Latin and was later translated into English in the 19th century by Dr. A. Jessop. Thomas of Monmouth described how Jews abducted the child. Afterwards, according to Thomas, this occurred. Having shaved William's head, he wrote, they stabbed it with countless thorn points and made the blood come horribly from the wounds they made. And cruel were they, and so eager to inflict pain, it was difficult to say whether they were crueler or more ingenious in their tortures. Thomas of Monmouth described the whole sordid event in detail, the abduction, the torture suffered by the child, and the bribes Jews gave to the sheriff and more. Thomas's efforts to document this Jewish occult rite of an innocent child eventually resulted in the child becoming a saint. And he was remembered until modern times, until the church no longer permitted such politically incorrect facts to be known. Thomas did a great service to the world in his efforts to eradicate child sacrifices by making known what had occurred on that dark, grisly day back in 1144. It put parents in England on alert, so they would know to take precautions to keep their children safe. Unfortunately, that was not the last such reported incident of Jewish ritual murder. Why would Jews continue to engage in such wicked crimes? Dr. Arnold Lees, who wrote a book about Jewish ritual murder in the early part of the 20th century in England, noted some interesting facts surrounding the ritual murders. A converted Jew called Theobald of Cambridge confessed that the Jews took blood once a year from a Christian child because they thought that only by so doing could they ever obtain their freedom and return to Palestine. And it was their custom to draw lots to decide whence the blood was to be supplied. The tragic murder that occurred to innocent William set a precedent. Because of Thomas of Monmouth's books that he wrote about the good child, others began to record these wicked deeds perpetrated by fanatical Jews. Some more of these reported victims follow. In 1243, in Kissingen, Bavaria, Jews were convicted by a court of law after having confessed to having used the blood of Gentiles for occult rites in their Jewish holiday of Passover. In the year 1255 in London, England, a young innocent Gentile by the name of Hugh was discovered to have been ritually murdered. His punctured body was found hidden on a Jew's property. After having reviewed the evidence, a court tried and convicted 18 prominent Jews of having committed the deed. The child was later canonized and became a saint. Altogether, before the Catholic Church became a bulwark for political correctness, there were over 20 children who had been ritually murdered by Jews and made into saints. In 1290 in Oxford, England, a Jew by the name of Isaac de Pouilly was arrested for the ritual murder of a Gentile child. Perhaps this was the defining moment, as Jews were permanently banished from England a month later. Many of these Jews fled to Germany or other European cities. It was only after the King of England himself was murdered 4 centuries later by Lord Cromwell that Jews were allowed back there, although the edict officially remains in effect. In 1331 in Gubelin, Germany, it was said the Jews had murdered a Gentile child for occult rites. The Jews were found guilty and were punished harshly for this deed. They were burnt alive. In the year 1345 in Munich, Germany, Jews reportedly punctured a Gentile child by the name of Henry in more than 60 places, causing the innocent child to be bled dry. In Venice, Italy, in the year 1420, according to local records, Jews ritually murdered a child in a cruel fashion, and they were executed for this inhumane crime. In the year 1462, in the village of Rinn, Innsbruck, in Austria, Jews reportedly ritually murdered a child by the name of Andela on a large stone. The child became a celebrated saint. A church was built around the stone. The city even became known as Judenstein, or the Jew Stone. More recently, in 1997, Professor Robert Brandner of a theological college in Austria said this about ritual murders. He said, "Jews should apologize for their deplorable crimes against Catholic children like the holy martyr child Andela von Rinn, and against adults in the days before Easter, and for the blood of murdered Christians spilt by Jewish hands, which cries to heaven too." Jews became a little perturbed when the Pope met with Professor Puntner. In the year 1475 in Trent, Italy, Jews reportedly ritually murdered a child by the name of Simon. During the process, they also circumcised the child. This has also been the reported case in many other such incidents, although we don't believe it's necessarily a requirement during the bloodletting process. This child, too, had puncture marks over his entire body. The child was later made a saint.
St. Simon of Trent was murdered in 1475 in Trent, Italy, a beautiful Renaissance city of the era. He was taken off the street by cult members, much as pedophile killers do today. The poor little boy was offered candy and lured away where he was murdered, or the pre-Passover sacrifice to obtain the blood for the rituals. This was a very, very famous case of the era, resulted in the later canonization as a Christian martyr of young Simon. The case is referred to in the book Blood Ritual as a multi-adjudicated case, in that it went before more than one tribunal. The Jewish perpetrators had money and influence, so the case went on appeal, which was a very rare thing in those days. Multi-adjudicated, it went also before the Vatican, where the congregation that decides who becomes a saint examined the case in very, very thorough detail. Simon was canonized, regarded as one of the most popular child saints of Europe, until 1965, when the politically correct ones in the Catholic Church decided to decanonize him.
In the book Lives of the Saints, Father Alban Butler described the child as an infant martyr and describes the events surrounding his murder thus. The Jews in the city of Trent decided to vent their hate by slaying a Christian child for the coming Passover, and Tobias, one of their number, was deputed to entrap a victim. He found a bright, smiling boy named Simon playing outside his home with no one guarding him. Tobias patted the little fellow's cheek and coaxed him to take his hand. Boy, 2 years ago.
Was it a conspiracy? Did you know that the police in Boston were broadcasting, "This is a drill, this is a drill," on bullhorns during the marathon? That the Boston Globe was tweeting that a demonstration bomb would be set off during the marathon for the benefit of bomb squad activities? And that one would be set off in 1 minute in front of a library, which happened as the Globe had announced. Peering through the smoke, you could see bodies with missing arms and legs. But there was no blood. The blood only showed up later and came out of a tube. They used amputee actors and a studio-quality smoke machine. Don't let yourself be played. Check out And Nobody Died in Boston Either. Available at moonrockbooks.com. That's moonrockbooks.com.
That the Capitol will ever treat us fairly, you are lying to yourselves. Because we know who they are and what they do. This is what they do, and we must fight back. You can torture us and bomb us. Fire is catching. And if we burn, you burn with us.
Good evening.
Are you awake yet? I hope. We've tried and we've tried for years and years to use passive resistance and loud voices to make a change. But time is over. Your governments around the world have no other goal than to decimate your entire existence. At the hands of the bankers and the elites. The war is coming, and it's your choice to decide if you want to be a warrior or a victim. Denial is not a choice.
anymore. Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported radio station on the planet. Not giving up. Revolution Radio.
It is no secret that the so-called mainstream media is best described as controlled propaganda. Countless news stories are either totally ignored or spun with half-truths, and because of this, essential facts and vital information are often compromised. Join Dr. Ott every Friday night on Studio B at 10 p.m. Eastern and learn why The Story Behind the Story was nominated for a Peabody Award in its second year of producing unparalleled broadcasting excellence in 1997. That is, if you really care about learning the truth.
The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates.
You're listening to Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
Surrounding his murder thus. The Jews in the city of Trent decided to vent their hate by slaying a Christian child for the coming Passover, and Tobias, one of their number, was deputed to entrap a victim. He found a bright, smiling boy named Simon playing outside his home with no one guarding him. Tobias patted the little fellow's cheek and coaxed him to take his hand. The boy, who was not 2 years old, did so, but he began to call and cry for his mother when he found himself being led from his home. Then Tobias silenced his grief and conducted him securely to his house. At midnight on Holy Thursday, the work of butchery began. They gagged his mouth. They held his arms in the form of a cross, while they pierced his tiny body with awls and bodkins in blasphemous mockery. After an hour's torture, the little martyr lifted his eyes to heaven and gave up his innocent soul. The Jews cast his body into the river. Their crime was discovered and punished, while the holy relics were enshrined in St. Peter's Church. In 1485, another Gentile child reportedly suffered a similar fate at Morestica. Pope Benedict XIV canonized the child and became known as St. Lorenzino, and mentioned the child as a martyr in his bull Beatus Andreas. The Episcopal Court of Padua, Italy, attested to the authenticity of this incident. Despite small differences, it is interesting to note that many other religious leaders have acknowledged these facts with respect to Jewish child murders. Cardinal Ganganelli, who later became a pope, once wrote, "I admit as true the fact of the Blessed Simon, a boy 3 years old, killed by the Jews of Trent. I also admit as a truth another fact, which happened in the year 1462 in the village of Rin, in the person of the Blessed Angela, a boy barbarous who was murdered by Jews." Reverend Dr. Martin Luther, founder of the Lutheran Church, briefly described his thoughts on this matter in his thesis, The Jews and Their Lies. In history, he says, therefore, they are often accused of poisoning wells, stealing children and mutilating them as in Trent, Weizensee, etc. Of course they deny this, be it so or not. However, I know completely well the full, ready will is not lacking with them if they could only transform it into deeds in secret or openly. Know this for a certainty and act accordingly. In 1492, LaGuardia, Spain, a child by the name of Christopher was said to have been ritually murdered by Jews. Shortly thereafter, Queen Isabella of Spain issued an edict had banished Jews from Spain forever. And it was not until approximately 1967 the Jews were officially allowed back. There were many reasons cited for the Jews' banishment, such as overall wickedness. But one reason was particularly interesting. It was called a serious and detestable crime. Well-respected historian William Walsh argues in his book, Isabella of Spain, that this crime was that of the ritual murder of Christopher, who later was made a saint.
In 1490, there was a vicious kidnapping and ritual murder of a young Christian boy taken from a small village called La Guardia, which is near present-day Toledo in Spain. He was taken out in the mountains into a cave and was killed by the ritual murder slaughterers there. It was a very, very, very famous case in Spain. It appears even today in various Spanish encyclopedias. The trial was in 1491. All the conspirators were convicted duly in court. This played a significant role in Queen Isabella and King Ferdinand making the decision, which they weren't quite sure of. But once this case, the publicity from this case, caused them to go ahead and make the decision to expel the entire Jewish people from Spain.
In 1502 in Prague, a Jew was found guilty of having murdered a Gentile child in an effort to extract the child's blood. In 1574, Lithuania, in the village of Pauna, the Jews reportedly tortured and then murdered a baby for occult rites. In 1598 in Lublin, in Kutnia, Poland, it was reported that Jews tortured three babies in those three cities. When the incident came to court, all Jews who were involved in the matter were discovered guilty. According to the book by the Russian writer Dr. Vladimir Dahl, Notes about the Ritual Murders, he says, "It is difficult to determine how many Jewish occult murders reportedly occurred in history." Montague Summers, a well-respected historian, describes some of his findings in his book, The History of Witchcraft and Demonology. Closely connected with these ancient sorceries are those ritual murders of which a learned Premonstratensian canon of Wilthen, Adrian Kemmerer, writing in 1745, was able to enumerate no less than 250. The latest of these having taken place in 1650, when at Kadan in Bohemia, Matthias, a lad of 4 years old, was killed by certain rabbis with several wounds. In many cases, the evidence is quite conclusive that the body, and especially the blood of the victim, was used for magical purposes. In 1663, Krakow in Poland, Rabbi Matatia Kalahora was believed to have murdered a Gentile child for his Jewish occult rites. He was tried, convicted, and executed for the crime. In 1669, near Metz in France, writes Dr. Dahl, the Jew Levi kidnapped a baby, which was later found dead in the forest. The guilty man was put to death. The details of this case were described in a small French book, Abrège du procès fait aux Juifs de Metz, a summary of the trial against the Jews in Metz in 1670. In 1619, Belarus, Jews reportedly murdered a young child by the name of Gavrild in a ritualistic fashion. In 1997, Belarusian television made a documentary about this child's murder. Only 23 years prior to America declaring its independence from England, Dr. Dahl describes an incident in 1753, Jitomir. He promulgated on Friday, the April the 20th, 1753, in the village of Markova, Vojnica. Jews caught three-year-old Stefan Struditsky and carried him away. On Sunday, the Jews gathered in a house, blindfolded the child, closed his mouth with pincers, and then, while holding the child in a tub, pricked him from all sides with sharp nails, moving him around in an effort to extract as much blood as possible. After the child had died, the corpse was carried to a forest, where the dead child was found the next day. By obvious evidence, the Jewesses Breiner and Frutza, without torment, confessed to having been involved in this killing and the husbands were exposed by them, and also, without a torment, confessed. Then other men were implicated and forced to undergo torture. These others confessed and made such a detailed description of this crime that no doubt could remain as to their guilt. The Jews who were involved were then executed. A picture of the child's corpse was drawn, which showed how it was found pricked over the entire body. This picture was kept safe with the Archbishop of Lvov. In 1791, in Tasnad, Hungary, Jews were again accused of ritually murdering a Gentile boy. In this particular case, one of the Jews' children admitted to having seen the entire sordid event. In 1797, in Galați, Romania, a child was allegedly ritually murdered by Jews. In the 19th century, explorer and linguist Sir Richard Francis Burton wrote a manuscript called Human Sacrifice Amongst the Sephardim, or Eastern Jews. Some Jews were somehow able to obtain his manuscript, which is held by the Jewish Board of Deputies in England, but not before part of this manuscript was published as the book The Jew, the Gypsy, and El Islam. In this book, Burton noted 1825, the Jews of Beirut made away with Fatallah Sayek, an Alpine Mohammedan. 1829, the Jews of Hama murdered a Mohammedan girl and were expelled from the city. 1839, a Jewish-owned flask of blood passed through the customs house of Beirut. In 1840, one of the most notorious ritual murders in modern times occurred, when a Catholic priest by the name of Father Thomas was ritually murdered. This was described in depth in Sir Richard Francis Burton's original manuscript, but not in the notes that were used for the book The Jew, the Gypsy, and El Islam. Fortunately, newspaper clippings and other books now tell this grisly tale in full.
In 1840, a Catholic Capuchin monk and priest, Father Thomas of Damascus, was kidnapped and ritually murdered by the cult in Damascus. Later, when his Arab servant came looking for him, they also seized the servant, murdered him. Bodies were cast down sewer drains, storm drains, and were hopefully to be hidden, though they were found later. The perpetrators were convicted. When I first discovered the book Blood Ritual, I became very interested in the write-up on that case, and I did my own research and wrote a small monograph called Debacle in Damascus, which tells the entire story of the case and uses many rare sources to prove the validity of the case. It was most famous occurrence, and until the later affair of Jack the Ripper, it was indeed the crime of the 19th century.
The New York Herald of April 6, 1850 reported the case on its front page under the title Mysteries of the Talmud, Terrible Murder in the East. The article, which is relatively long, describes the vicious murder of Father Thomas. Who would have dreamt of beholding the bloody mysteries of the Talmud exposed in their turn, and of having the trial of one of the most savage and ferocious murders ever yet recorded in the annals of criminality, once more brought before the public? Who would have imagined that certain fanatics used human blood to moisten their holy, unleavened bread? Our readers will undoubtedly recollect the universal sensation created throughout the world by the discovery of Father Tommaso, a Christian missionary from Sardinia, and his servant, Abrahim Amara. They had both been bled to death, their limbs chopped off joint by joint, their bones pounded in the mortar, and their mutilated remains thrown into a drain in the city of Damascus. The manuscripts of the original trial, as sealed by the French and Austrian councils of that city, are now in the city. We can therefore defy the great nation to contradict the truth of our statements. Mustafa Talas, who has a doctorate in history and is an attorney, went to the difficult task of obtaining the original transcripts of the investigation and records from France, where Father Thomas was a citizen, and translating all these into English. He should be commended on his investigative work. He published all this in a book called Matzel of Zion, which is now being made into a movie. It may have Omar Sharif, who played the lead role in the movie Dr. Zhivago, play the part of Father Thomas. Dr. Talas describes the investigation. The investigator said, "You have mentioned in your testimony that the Jews extracted the blood of Christians and used it to make bread. It is known by your belief that blood is not clean and is forbidden by your religion even when taken from lawfully slain animals. It is not lawful to use blood. There exists a contradiction between blood being impure and forbidden and that of its being lawful if taken from a Christian human being, especially to make bread for the holy day. Is there any logical or convincing proof that will explain this contradiction?" Ayn Muslimani, who is a Jewish convert to Islam, answered, "The Talmud says that there are two kinds of blood pleasing to God, the blood of Passover and the blood of circumcision." Rabbi Yaakov, the head rabbi of Syria, added, "God loves two kinds of blood, the Passover sacrificial blood and the blood of circumcision." Investigator Shubli Ayub responded, "We do not understand very well how it is permissible to use human blood." Ayn Muslimani answered, "The chief rabbis know by the codes given to them how and when it is permissible to use this blood." The Jewish writer Jonathan Frankel wrote the book The Damascus Affair that was supposed to counter Dr. Talas's book. Of course, it appears that Frankel's book doesn't reveal nearly as much about the incident as Dr. Talas's book, probably because Frankel might want to keep the truth of the event concealed. It is interesting to point out that two people independently of each other took investigators to the same place where the remains of Father Thomas were discovered, in the sewer behind a rabbi's home where hate-mongering Jews had reportedly put the priest's chopped-up remains. Just a decade after the Damascus incident in 1850 in New York City, reports were made of Jews murdering children. Approximately 100 irate Irishmen accompanied by the local police broke into a synagogue to save the victim. It's unclear whether they were able to save a child. In 1899, Jews allegedly ritually murdered Agnes Chodza of Polna. One of the culprits who purportedly murdered her was initially sentenced to death. A year later, in 1900, some fanatical Jews were said to have ritually murdered Ernst Winter. In 1911, Kiev, Russia, one of the most notorious Jewish ritual murders occurred. An innocent young child by the name of Andrei Yushinsky was discovered to have been killed for occult rites. Menachem Mendel Bailis was accused of being the perpetrator of the crime. Jews from around the world sought to conceal the true nature of the crime, and they spent over the equivalent of at least $115 million in today's money so that the Bailey's team of lawyers would win the case. Several witnesses died under mysterious conditions prior to trial. Mishuk, a high-ranking police investigator, was proven to have planted false evidence to benefit Bailey's. Three innocent children who had been with Andre and witnessed the abduction by Bailey's were given pieces of cake by a scurrilous investigator named Krasovsky, and the next day all three became ill. Two died as a result, and the third was sick for months. The one who survived, Ludmila Chaberiak, said, "We started to ride the clay mixer. Suddenly, Bailis and two other Jews ran towards us. We jumped off the clay mixer and tried to run away. Andrei and my brother, Zhenya, were caught by Bailis and the other Jews, but my brother freed himself. The Jews then dragged Andrei away. My younger sister, Valentina, also saw this." John Grant, who was the American consulate stationed in Odessa, Russia, at the time, reported the jury's final verdict. Grant noted that it was determined by a jury that a certain boy found cruelly murdered in Kiev had been killed by fanatical Jews, and that Jews, for occult purposes, had carefully drawn all blood from the dying child, that it was an instance of Jewish ritualistic murder, that Bailis was innocent. While it was proven to have taken place inside the synagogue at the Jewish-owned Saitsev factory, the jury could not determine for certain that Bailis was the one who wielded the awl, causing Andrei to be punctured over 45 times around his body, in an effort to procure as much blood as possible. If you look closely, and I realize it might be difficult, but if you look closely, you can see 13 puncture marks to the side of the child's cranium, which Jews reportedly did as part of some sort of ritual as a sacrifice so they could overthrow the Tsar. Nevertheless, Bailis was freed, because only 6 of the 12 jurors felt he was guilty, a simple majority being required. Too many witnesses were killed and much evidence had been destroyed prior to trial. Much like O.J. Simpson in the U.S., Bailis was allowed to walk unpunished. Later, he immigrated to the United States, where he lived out the rest of his life. Prosecuting attorney G.G. Zamoslovsky wrote a 520-page book about this, which was called The Murder of Andrei Yushinsky. But the Bolshevik Revolution occurred shortly thereafter. Jews participated in Zamoslovsky Kangaroo Court, which was the very first trial of the communist regime. Zamoslovsky was murdered for having revealed all the facts concerning this matter. His book was then classified until 1997 so that others might not know the truth of this terrible ordeal. At around the same time as the trial of Menachem Mendel Bailis was being given, Leo Frank was tried for the murder of a 12-year-old Gentile girl, Mary Fagan, in the United States. Frank was the chapter head of the Atlanta Jewish Society B'nai B'rit, which is Hebrew for Brotherhood of the Covenant. Frank was found guilty of murdering the young Gentile girl. One writer described the child's innocent, lifeless body. She bled freely, not only from the wound in her head, but from other parts of her body. An objective view of this incident is thoroughly described in the more recent book, The Murder of Little Mary Fagan. Because it is impartial, Jews seem to be disturbed by it. Shortly after Fagan's murder, Jews formed the Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rit, which has consistently sought to contain the incident. Jews now say that it was not a Jew who murdered Mary Fagan, but rather a black. We are expected to believe that a jury in the Deep South in the early 1900s would let a guilty black man who murdered an innocent white girl go free so that an innocent white Jew could be convicted of having murdering a Gentile child in the most wicked ways imaginable? This, of course, is utter nonsense.
In 1913, in Atlanta, Georgia, the manager of a pencil factory, his name was Leo Frank, murdered one of his employees, a young Christian girl by the name of Mary Fagan. This was a very, very famous case of the early 20th century. And the B'nai B'rith organization, other Jewish groups, came out to try to show that Fagan was only being accused in the matter because of the dreaded anti-Semitism. Matter of fact, this gave rise to the organization, misnamed organization known today as the Anti-Defamation League, or ADL, and this is where they began their work.
After much haggling and money thrown at the matter, 73 years after the incident, Jews secured a pardon of Frank. Frank was not pardoned because of his innocence, as Jews would have some believe. In fact, Jews had tried to appeal the conviction at the time, but Frank was repeatedly shown to be guilty. Later, the governor, on his way out, changed Frank's sentence, who was to be punished by death by a court order, to a life sentence. A lynch mob took Frank from jail and hanged him. This is the reason why Frank was pardoned, because of the lynch's mob doing justice's job, not because of Frank's imagined innocence. Someone supposedly remembered what happened 70 years after the incident, but this contrived memory was probably more based on the individual's inability to purchase a pacemaker to continue living and his Jewish beneficiaries wanting to vindicate their deceased co-religionist. In 1919, a Gentile accused Jews of ritually murdering his child in Chicago. It is not certain whether this event was truly a ritual murder or merely a baseless accusation. In some cases, though, certainly not all, Jews are unfairly accused of ritually murdering children. For example, this occurred in 1928 in Messina, New York, when some townspeople accused Jews of ritually murdering a child who was in fact merely lost in the woods, according to Jewish writers. People should not jump to conclusions in such matters. Rather, criminal investigators should look into these matters and take whatever legal action is necessary to prevent these iniquitous crimes from occurring, and should also see to it that innocent Jews are not maligned. In 1935, the Russian paper Nashput of Harbin on 7th of October reported a case in Afghanistan where a Mohammedan child was robbed and riddled with stabs by Jews, the court verdict being that this was done for ritual purposes. Most people who have investigated these matters were distinguished individuals. Dr. Dahl, who was mentioned earlier, was a well-respected linguist and author of Russian's Living Dictionary, roughly the equivalent of Webster's Dictionary for the United States. Many such well-respected people as Dr. Dahl have said that Jewish ritual murder is true. For instance, Increase Mather, an early administrator of Harvard University, once said, "Jews have been wont once a year to steal Christian children and to put them to death by crucifying out of scorn and hatred." Attorney Thomas E. Watson publicly promulgated that occult murders among Jews was common. In 1896, when he ran as third-party vice president candidate, his party received over 1 million votes. Later, in 1920, he was elected to the United States Senate. Many others have previously been mentioned. Many Jews who became proselyte Christians in the past have written about these murders as well. For instance, Michael, the Grand Rabbi of Lithuania, who converted to Christianity, described many of these hateful acts perpetrated by Jews. In Dr. Dahl's book, we see many Jewish converts who admitted to the truth of this matter. On the 16th of April, 1989, an interesting article appeared in the New York Times. While inconclusive, I'd like to read it to you. A long-lost skeleton in a synagogue cellar. A dark, or in any case bizarre, chapter in the otherwise venerable history of the Eldridge Street Synagogue on the Lower East Side was reopened yesterday when a long-lost skull rolled out from a coal ash pile and struck the foot of a workman. Soon, an entire skeleton was in view. After inspection by a medical examiner, the bones were taken to the 5th Precinct Station House. The official word from the police was that they could not identify the body or determine its sex. It had apparently been in the cellar more than 30 years. The unofficial word, according to Betty Sandler, administrative director of the Eldridge Street Project, was that it might be a young girl in her late teens or early 20s, which would make for an unsavory story. Workers are excavating the cellar of the 102-year-old synagogue between Canal and Division Streets in the first phase of its restoration. Not the faintest rumor or oldest lore explains the skeleton, Judge Paul P. E. Bookson of Civil Court, who has worshipped the synagogue for 3 decades, said he had absolutely no information, no inkling as to who it might be or how it came to be there. Now, think about this. How could a child's skeleton just be found in a coal pile in a Jewish synagogue's basement? If the corpse was that of a Jewish child, being that Jewish communities are usually pretty tightly knit, it seems likely that someone at the synagogue would have known who was killed. But they had absolutely no information, no inkling about whose corpse was discovered. So it stands to reason that it was not a Jew. So why would the skeleton of a Gentile be discovered in a synagogue's basement? This is a valid question, and it certainly deserves a valid response. But it seems that those who were investigating the matter simply dismissed it for reasons that only they will know. Also, why did it say that the investigators could not determine its sex for certain? This would be a relatively simple task for a medical examiner. Yet it seems that even this was not given proper attention. Now, one cannot say that with any certainty that the remains were that of a child who was ritually murdered, but it does seem like a matter that still needs proper attention by police investigators. Nearly a month later, something else interesting occurred in 1989.
On May the 1st, 1989, viewers of the Oprah Winfrey Show, a very famous television program, were in for quite a surprise. Oprah interviewed a young Jewish girl named Rachel, who testified on the program that her family had for several generations engaged in the practice of ritual murder.
On the show, Dr. Rome cites, Oprah asked the woman, "This is the first time I've heard of any Jewish people sacrificing babies. But anyway, so you witnessed the sacrifice?" Rachel responded, "Right. When I was young, I was forced to participate in that, in which I had to sacrifice an infant." When Oprah Winfrey asked if other Jews had engaged in such practices, Rachel responded, "There's other Jewish families across the country. It's not just my family." Rachel then proceeded to mention other relatives, doctors, policemen, council members, and so forth, who had also reportedly engaged in this cult activity. A year later, in 1990, Rachel again bravely stepped forward and admitted that this terrible deed had occurred, as noted in the March 1990 issue of Cult Watch Response. "Recently, I had enough courage to share some of my story. I revealed that I am a Jewish survivor of a multi-generational family who practiced human sacrifice and cannibalism. It seems likely that if the transgenerational Jewish ritual murder cult has survived, that such actions would most likely occur in Israel, where many fanatical Jews reside." A few years later, in 1995, some Gentile children from Romania were found being reportedly kidnapped and exported to Israel. Israeli citizen Mahmoud Asadi was arrested for this. He was at one time former Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin's personal secretary, according to the World Jewish Congress. Certainly, he would not have been acting alone in this matter, as it would be something that would require many people to do. Why would he be in Romania procuring Gentile children? Some have suggested that the children were to be used in occult rites by Jews. Again, this is a question that deserves our utmost attention. Reporter Adel Hamoud, writing in the major Egyptian newspaper Al-Aram of October 28, 2000, said that young Palestinian children have been repeatedly found around Israel with their blood drained. He reported these startling findings in a full-page article called "Jews Make Matzos from the Arabs' Blood." Jews in Israel regularly demonstrate that they possess this ancient hatred. Recently, Israeli planes dropped bombs on a school for the blind in Palestine, and some Jewish extremists put a bomb on a school children's playground. Certainly, Jewish fanatics who commit such cruel acts are capable of ritually murdering children in Palestine as well. Romania, Germany, Italy, Poland, United States, Egypt, Syria, Portugal, Jordan, France, Russia, Austria, Spain. Nearly every civilization in the entire world has reported the crime of Jewish ritual murders. Has the entire world been involved in a massive conspiracy against Jews? Or have some fanatical Jews been engaged in a conspiracy against all non-Jews? Quite frankly, it seems to be the latter. Some Jews say the Jews are completely innocent. For instance, Jewish scholar Richard Pochiachia writes in his book, The Myth of Ritual Murder, that Jews never use any blood, even that of an animal. On page 8, however, contradicting himself, on the very next page he says, "In medieval and early modern times, among Oriental Jews, the blood of circumcision was used for writing the Tetragrammaton on talismans." On that same page, Pochiachia also noticed that the rabbi's responsa said to use dried goat's blood as a general medicine. This certainly makes it seem as if there was some relationship to occultism in the past. There does seem to be an ancient relationship between Jews and occultism in the past up to this very day. As surprising as it may be, the founder of modern-day Satanism, Anton LaVey, is Jewish. Also, Lord Egan, who is a leader of satanic cult, is also Jewish. If you look at the satanic pentagram with the demon Baphomet in the center. An imaginary demon from ancient times, you'll see Hebrew characters that surround it as well. In the current video, Faces of Death, you'll see an interracial cult, which appears to be led by a Jew, cut up a corpse, and then have an orgy in its blood. Such sickness defies belief. Dr. Vladimir Dahl, who we mentioned earlier, was asked to write his book, Notes About the Ritual Murders, for the Russian government. And he mentioned many of the sick occult rites of the ritual murders of the past. Dahl was able to find out quite a lot about these acts. While his book was written long ago, there are still many relevant points that are still applicable today. He describes these terrible acts by hate-mongering Jews and the typical Jewish response. It was not just one group of people who have accused Jews of committing such deplorable acts. Jews were accused many times of that in courts by a variety of people. On the whole, it was not only their own confession in addition to other evidence, but there were such examples where the Jews were exposed and consequently had recognized themselves as being true. Just one such event should obviously be enough for people to acknowledge the real existence of such villainous human mutilation. But the defenders of Jews say something quite different. The confessions were forced by torture and therefore proves nothing. Assuming, however, this argument is true too, and believing all that was ever said and written on this problem in favor of Jews with respect to forced confessions, there is still one circumstance that will remain, which has never paid enough attention. This circumstance not only remains as unexplained by Jews, but also is the proof of the crime itself. Namely, it is not doubtful that from time to time the corpses of babies who were missing were eventually discovered in such distorted conditions and with such signs of external violence that they attested to images of excruciatingly painful deaths. This is the kind of murder for which the Jews are accused. Also, the incidents of this nature exclusively occurred only in places where the Jews live. We must ask ourselves, in what type of circumstance can we attribute the renewed cases of babies who suffered painful deaths, babies who were carefully tortured up to the point of their tragic deaths, if an accusation is not fair? What reason can we invent for the villainous torture of a baby if it is not done for religious mutilation? The external signs on corpses indicate each time this is discovered, positively, that the death could not be accidental in any case, but intentional. It is obvious that these injuries sustained by the babies are deliberately done and take place over a long time. The whole body is poked or pricked, then scraps of skin are cut. The tongue was often cut out. The intimate parts of boys are either cut out or the boys were circumcised. Signs of bruises from tight bandages put on and removed again are not uncommon. Often the entire skin has abrasions, as if it was burnt or had something rubbing against it. Sometimes the corpse was even washed, with it being discovered without any blood on it. Nor was there any blood on the undergarments or clothes, demonstrating that they were taken off during the murder and afterwards put on again. The parents and siblings of babies who have experienced such tragic deaths wonder, for what possible reason would people commit such deplorable acts to innocent babies? Without a purpose, it could never be done. And it continues to happen repeatedly over time. The ordinary killer in any case would be satisfied with one murder, but a murderer who kills for some type of mysterious, important purpose cannot be ignored here. The weak, unsatisfactory searching of investigators, the different tricks of Jews, their impudent and stubborn denials, not infrequently bribery, the confidence by the majority of educated people in that an accusation is merely infamous slander, and finally, the humanity of our criminal laws. All these things save the Jewish culprits nearly every time from deserved execution. And they, by using their machinations, by giving false oath assurances of innocence, and by using false propaganda that suggested such accusations were merely the result of accomplished injustice with slander built on them, almost always were well prepared for such accusations. The Jews punished those who demonstrated credible evidence against them. You might ask when these fanatical Jews are said to have engaged in such wicked behavior. Typically, these Jewish sacrificial events usually occurred around the time of the Jewish holiday of Passover, which has an underlying message of deeply imbued pathological hatred towards Gentiles. Similar claims have been made around Hanukkah, a Jewish militant holiday. Purim is also another Jewish holiday on which Gentile children are said to disappear, only to be found later mutilated. Purim celebrates when, in history, Jews were able to murder a noble Gentile. Haman, his wife, his children, and also murdered thousands of other Gentiles who sought to put an end to wicked acts perpetrated by Jews who were criminals. This might be viewed as similar to what occurred to the good Tsar of Russia, his wife, his son who was sick, his daughters and all the other relatives, not to mention over 40 million other Russians. Of course, Jews now vehemently deny having anything to do with this. The records speak for themselves. It seems to follow the ancient lines of this Purim, a festival that is commonly associated with ritual murders by Jewish fanatics in the past. Passover is celebrated amongst Jews when angels supposedly came through a city in ancient times and murdered all non-Jews who didn't have an X written in blood on their homes. In all actuality, it seems likely that the wholesale slaughter of Gentiles in a village was perpetrated by a band of Jewish cutthroats at night rather than angels. Many ritual murders also reportedly occurred around the time of Passover. There is a question which remains to be asked. If what I have said so far about Jewish occult murder having occurred around the globe is true, why don't we hear more about these crimes? Well, that is a fair question. The truth of the matter might also surprise some here today. Jews control the media for the most part. Jews say that such talk is merely hateful anti-Semitism, but it is not. Rather, it is a fact with which we must deal. As early as 1916, we see well-respected Thomas Burbage write that by means of the press, the Jews control, and their great wealth, Jews are able to stifle any impartial investigation into ritual murder. One need only to search the internet to find the validity that Jews, for the most part, do control the press, and television, and radio too, for that matter. As noted previously, Jews try to suppress any talk about Jewish ritual murder. This includes even other Jewish news sources that mention this. And even when it might be only a vague reference. For example, in 1996, Newsweek merely used the term blood libel in an article. The article was called A New Kind of Blood Libel. It was not about Jews committing ritual murders, but about Israelis mishandling black Jews' blood. On February the 12th, 1996, B'nai B'rit President Tommy Bauer wrote Newsweek a scathing letter which said, "I trust that you will issue an explanation and an apology for this gross error of judgment." Even in foreign nations, Jews try to control what people write. The Zionist Organization of America pressured the Egyptians to retract the aforementioned article about a reported Jewish ritual murder that had reportedly occurred and was mentioned in their newspaper Al-Haram, lest America purportedly refrain from giving the Egyptians any aid. The Zionist Organization of America President Morton A. Klein wrote, "We urge Congress to refrain from considering the Clinton administration's proposal for $225 million in extra aid to Egypt until the Mubarak government publicly apologizes and repudiates the blood libel article and replaces the editor responsible for its publication." Jews reportedly even had what is called a slush fund to defend themselves in court and such. Dr. Devere's book writes about this. Alilat Sika, a slush fund in today's terms, provided bribe money and expenses to combat blood accusations. Dr. Rome then proves this by citing Jewish author Leon Poliakoff's book, The History of Antisemitism. The disappearance of a Gentile child had to be redeemed by Jewish blood, or at least by Jewish money, which sometimes permitted the matter to be dropped. The secret fund, the Alilat Seeker, the fund for bloody calumnies, set up by the Council of the Four Nations, served chiefly for this purpose. Another way that Jews tried to stifle debate on this topic is through psychological barriers. Jews do this by exaggerating events of World War II Germany and trying to keep such thoughts fresh in our minds. At the same time, Jews tried to avoid talk of the Bolshevik Revolution, which Jews were overwhelmingly dominant and which resulted in the murder of over 40 million Gentile Russians. In a sense, this was the greatest number of Jewish ritual murders to occur en masse. Even if the hateful acts were not performed in the Jewish traditional manner, since it was an act based on Jewish contempt, superiority, and utilized the semantic mind games that they have employed for countless generations. An example of these psychological games that Jews play can be seen in many respected Jewish works. For example, Jewish author Gavin Langmuir writes in his book, Towards the Definition of Antisemitism, not only are Jews good in their eyes, but they are now seen as no worse than, or as good as, anyone else in the West. Consequently, antisemitism is now understood as a highly pejorative term both by Jews and many non-Jews, which is what makes the charge of antisemitism, loosely defined, so useful a weapon in political discourse. So long as memories of the final solution remain vivid, the use of that special term of dark origin implies that there is something unusually and uniquely evil about any serious hostility towards all Jews. As you noticed, he said that this term of antisemitism is useful as a weapon in political discourse. Hence, it seems he is suggesting that Jews use a psychological guilt trip on anyone who disagrees with them, which is what happens in politics. This is one of the reasons that people should not waste time refuting ignorant Jewish arguments when Jews apply the term antisemite. Anyone who tells the truth in relation to the reprehensible acts committed by Jews will be labeled as such. The fact that Jews play such insipid little games should simply be accepted and merely ignored. Responding to such claims with a whatever, rather than fall into their dull mind games and wasting time refuting their lies with the obvious truth that contradicts their claims. Truth is anti-Semitic, according to Jews, if they do not like the way it reflects on them. And what is the truth? There are many such works that spell out all the nefarious details of these wicked crimes. Jewish Ritual Murder by Dr. Arnold Lees. And there is another book by the same name, Jewish Ritual Murder by Dr. Helmut Schramm, which also describes this and has recently been translated into English and is available on a CD. There is a booklet by Dr. Harold Rome called Debacle in Damascus. Well-respected writer Michael Hoffman wrote about this in one of his newsletters. Dr. Ed Fields dedicated an older issue of his newspaper about this. Dr. James Warner has reproduced an older German newspaper about this. Dr. A. Jessup's translation of The Life of Sir William of Norwich is an interesting book. Dr. William Sharp also wrote about the murder of William in an article that appeared in the New York State Journal of Medicine of the 1st of November, 1971. Dr. Mustafa Talas's book, The Matzah of Zion, tells about the ritual murder of Father Thomas. Dr. Philip DeVere has written recently a book called Blood Ritual. There is another videotape, if you can find it, which shows numerous rare pictures, woodcuts, and drawings of Jewish ritual murders called Human Sacrifice Among the Fanatical Hasidic Jews from the Ancient Times to the present. Russian prosecutor and Duma member G.G. Samoslovsky wrote an excellent 500 or more page book that told all the details of one case in which a jury determined there had been a Jewish ritual murder. Dr. Vladimir Dal's book is also an excellent resource, and much of which contained in this video was derived from his excellent resource. There are many other writers, from popes to attorneys to numerous other doctors and researchers, who attest to the validity of Jewish ritual murder accusations. You might wonder, how often do ritual murders occur? This is a question that cannot honestly be answered, because no such tabs are kept. Such actions must certainly be kept secretive amongst Jewish occults, lest people put an end to their despicable activities. Obviously, since the FBI is indoctrinated by the Jewish Anti-Defamation League at the Holocaust Museum, they will not dare to question their masters. It is doubtful that law enforcement even bother to determine why non-Jewish construction workers in a synagogue basement in 1989 discovered a child's skeleton. How many victims are not properly investigated because Jews are believed incapable of such wicked acts? There are some alarming facts that are known. According to the FBI, in the year 2000, 876,213 people went missing. Now, not all of them were children, but quite a few were, 750,000. Of that figure, around half of them, 354,000 to be precise, were abducted by other members of their family. This still leaves quite a number, 400,000 children, the equivalent of over 1,000 children per day, go missing. Of course, it seems likely that many may have run away from their homes and others may be abandoned. But what happened to the others? Some of these children are kidnapped and never seen again. This occurs to at least several thousand a year. And what happens to them? Are they abducted by predators? Please keep a close eye on your children. In particular, watch out for the events of Passover, Purim, and Hanukkah. Do not let your children wander far away, particularly in areas visited by Jews during their Jewish holidays.
Wow. That's just devastating. And while you could only hear the audio track, it's a video presenting documents, photographs, records, substantiating case after case after case. In the description for today's program, I'll include the link. What I just played is on Rumble, Jewish Ritual Murder Revisited, The Hidden Cult. And I have to say, I found this not just convincing, but overwhelming. It's the sort of thing one would never want to contemplate could be the truth. But where my own reporting on the extent to which the American Congress is Jewish dominated, where the pledge revealed by Cynthia McKinney requires members of our own Congress to pledge to put the interests of Israel ahead of even the interests of the United States, where you can see that playing out in Ukraine, which has no conceivable national security or military benefit to the United States as an independent sovereign nation, and yet we're going all out. The fake actor wearing a Biden mask has declared, "We will be with you to the end." Nancy Pelosi is just coming out saying, "We must stand with Ukraine as a bastion to freedom and democracy when Ukraine is neither." But then, the United States, alas, cannot be claimed to be a bastion of freedom or democracy either. The way in which our election system has been rigged, the corruption exercise by the Democrat Party, the power of the media, which we all know is dominated by Jews. I've reported having panels of 100 executives from CNN, every one of whom is a dual U.S. Israeli citizen. 100 executives from NBC, every one of whom is a dual U.S. Israeli citizen. 100 executives from the New York Times, every one of whom is a dual U.S. Israeli citizen. The situation is catastrophic. The tail is wagging the dog. Look at remarks by Ariel Sharon or Bibi Netanyahu or other Menachem Begin of contempt, not only toward the United States, but of all non-Jews of the Goyim, whereby the Talmud, the Goyim only exist to serve the Jews. Think about it. Your fate depends on understanding where we are today.
Enter into a world unseen on Raven Star's Witching Hour. You will encounter eclectic topics from the realm of spirit brought into our matrix of truth. With your host, the Solaris Blue Raven. Solaris will bring you an array of unique guests covering topics from ghostly spirits to amazing anomalies, covert technology, UFOs, and shadowy global events.
And that's right here at Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, Saturdays, midnight till 2 a.m. Eastern Time. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
Let the magic rise.
This is Thomas, a.k.a. a Mad Painter. I'd like you to join me Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for Open Canvas. Don't forget to bring an open mind.
Yes, folks, that's right. Bring an open mind to an open canvas. Again, that is Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern. UFOs to government corruption. This is Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. You don't need to expect us. We're already here.
We did not engage in conflict that was out of line with our mission.
Is it disloyalty? Is it sedition? Is it treason to oppose the hands of tyranny? Never!
I will never send troops anywhere on a mission of that kind without telling them that if somebody shoots at them, they can darn well shoot back.
I know not what course others may take, but as for me,
give me liberty! Oh, give me!
A dark cloud is finally lifting across the world as U.S. military intelligence...